accession number 22155, Reel 4.
Do it properly, you've got a fairly large capacity.
Well, I think it was an opportunity for me to get to know lots of countries I wouldn't otherwise have been to, Botswana, Mozambique. First time I was in South Africa. They actually allowed me in South Africa for short periods. And Zambia for the first time. I suppose it wasn't much more than journalistic tourism. Some of the ritual handshakes and so on, but I would like to think I had an understanding of the situation, but I doubt it really. I don't think I did anything that I would wish to be remembered by during those assignments.
Did you have any particular sympathy, though, in the Rhodesian situation for the African population or the
Well, I think so. I think so, and I don't think a sympathy for the African population excluded a sympathy for the settlers whose lives are already being ruined. I mean, the loss of life was already quite high and the need for political settlement was overwhelming on both sides. So I don't think sympathy for one side precluded sympathy for the other. I think to be a foreign correspondent to do it properly, you've got a fairly large capacity for sympathy, actually.
Yes, so it would seem that, you know, you were neutral.
I was, in my career, I wasn't really neutral. I used to seek out the supposed bad guys. I would spend time later on with the Afrikaners in South Africa, with the loyalist paramilitaries in Belfast, with the Serbs in Bosnia, because very often these were the people, the hardliners, who held the key to a settlement, and you had to understand them. And it wasn't my job to denounce them anyway. So, I mean, I wasted probably more time than any of the other Bosnian reporters just spending time at Serbian roadblocks trying to get to know them, being rebuffed. That's the way I used to work it. I didn't like to divide the world into good guys and bad guys. Well, if I did, I rather liked the bad guys. I mean, one of my friends whose company I liked was Arkan, the guerrilla, the warlord in chief. Interesting man. He controlled access to certain places. He had demotic English. He spoke for a certain faction of the Serbian people. He ran his private army. And I'd much rather be his friend than his enemy. He's now, of course, no longer with us. But that's how I used to operate.
Next big war, Martin.
It came following the invasion of Kuwait by the Iraqis in August 1990. We all went rushing out as soon as we could get visas, which was no easy matter. And I spent a lot of time between August 1990 and January 1991 just waiting for the war, watching the British task force arrive, getting to know the soldiers, and so on.
You were actually with the army, were you?
Not at that time. They had what I thought was a reasonably enlightened media policy. They'd learned some lessons from the Falklands. And when it actually came to the very short war, if you can even call it a war, the recuperation of Kuwait, they decided to... there were two armoured brigades, the 7th and the 4th, and each would have a team of seven journalists attached to it, still photographers, writers, one television crew with each. And by the luck of the draw, I was fortunate to be with my cameraman, Nigel Bateson, attached to the 7th armoured brigade, led by Brigadier Patrick Cordingley, who were, well, in my view, there was one commander who succeeded in that war and one who didn't, much the same as in the Falklands. And certainly the 7th Armoured Brigade were a good bunch to be with. They were the Staffordshire Regiment of Armoured Infantry, and two cavalry regiments, the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards and the Queen's Royal Irish Hussars, with all the bits and pieces attached. And we were definitely among the bits and pieces attached. We were sort of a rear echelon administratively, but when the invasion or the ground attack happened, we were attached to the various regiments, and I was right up there with the artillery major attached to General Arthur Denaro, Colonel Arthur Denaro, who was leading the Queen's Royal Irish Hussars. So I went into war as an Irishman, and it was very privileged. We were under very strict censorship. I mean, we were told the plan. We were shown the 60-page document of the plan of attack, but there was no way we could have broadcast it. I myself would not have wanted to, because you're endangering your own life as well as the lives of the soldiers if you do. Anyway, the military controlled our communications entirely. There was a satellite truck at divisional headquarters, and what would happen was, in theory, was our tapes would go back there, be edited, beamed out and back, and a censorship would apply in the satellite truck. The army attack had two extremely good, relatively senior officers overseeing this operation. Nothing like it had ever been tried before. I mean, the Americans know this. Press traveling with and theoretically transmitting from an armored force. And we went up and down with them in a tent before it all happened about what we were not allowed to report. There was a lot of sensitivity about casualties, which I understand. It was generally agreed that after it was over, we could say what we liked. While it was going on, what actually happened was the ground attack was so quick and there was so little resistance. It was all over in 100 hours, much less than 100 hours. We were across the Basra Road with the Irish Hussars and had met very little resistance. This was one of my main causes of anxiety. Well, partly it was atmospheric. It was incredibly dark because the burning oil wells blocked out the sunlight. So it was like the whole thing took place in a sort of a twilight zone. And as you're going forward through minefields and into who knows what dangers, obviously you were going to be trapped inside an armored vehicle, and armored vehicles are not made for shooting movies out of. It was all you could get was a little sort of postage stamp, postcard size window at the back, which is highly unsatisfactory. But after about 12 hours of this, we stopped and sort of reviewed where we were. And the brigadier decided to call in a tremendous artillery barrage on the known Iraqi positions ahead of us so we could get out and take pictures of that. And then we, come the dawn, we got up on that high ground and there was just thousands of Iraqis surrendering. So there were some sort of amazing pictures there. And after that, it became quite clear to us that the Iraqi officers just left and abandoned the men to surrender. And there was no resistance, so I was able to persuade Nigel Bates, and we could actually get on the roof of the warrior armored vehicle in which we were traveling, and later on the top of the colonel's wagon. And really, we were in no danger at all. It's probably the safest war I'd ever reported. The difficulty was that we were so far ahead of our logistical column that I had no way of getting the stuff back to the satellite truck, and we finally caught up with it. We took a helicopter and found it 4 days later. So the pictures of all this stuff never got to London for 4 days. That was what, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men, gang and lay. But I think it was a reasonable effort. At least there was some press with the military to show what it was like. Obviously, we were going to get a lot of flack from the free spirits who were not in the military pools for being tools and lackeys of the military, but I think the answer to that is that for any consumer of the news, whether on press or television, you get it from a whole variety of sources, and it is valuable to have the pictures up with the frontline soldiers at the point of attack, just as it's valuable to have whatever can be scavenged around the outside, or for that matter, whatever can be got from the other side of the lines. So it doesn't claim to be a whole picture of the war. It was fragmentary, But I thought it was worth doing.
You know, from what you're saying, it would seem that it would probably be the only way of getting pictures of that war, wasn't it?
Well, there was no other way. Again, there were huge numbers of press in Dhahran and Riyadh. Of course, a lot of the official, especially the American, daily communiques came out of Riyadh, and there was a place for that. As for the NATO bombing of Kosovo, you need to get the official account of things. But you also need to have somebody up front. And I suppose there were maybe 1,000 journalists in Dhahran. Were 1,000 journalists going to be given the freedom of the battlefield? What happens then is that they get into trouble. They run out of water. They run out of petrol. And the military, instead of fighting the engagement, they spend all their time looking after these lost souls. So they imposed very strict battlefield security. A lot of people who tried to get there freelance were turned back by military police at critical junctions. And the only people who really had the run of the battlefield, so to speak, were the pool press and television teams. And I'm sure that in any future war, something where the military control the battlefield, something like that will be done. I imagine it was a bit like that in the Second World War. There were certain accredited correspondents and who could get there and others could not. A lot of thought to it.
Quite an experience, wasn't it?
It was.
With the Seventh Army.
Yes, we'd all been listening too much to the nonsense coming out of Baghdad about the mother of all wars, and we didn't know what kind of resistance the Iraqis would put up. What we hadn't expected that they would put up virtually none. They just turned and ran, which made it as a military operation, I wouldn't say disappointing, because I was rather pleased, but not quite what we expected. You know, they could have used their chemical weapons and biological weapons. They could have done more with their Frog and SAM missiles than they did, but they didn't.
Was that a really serious threat, the nuclear and biological weapons?
Well, you never know. We knew, not nuclear, but we knew he had, because his nuclear facility was destroyed by the Israelis. Chemical, biological, yes. You were always aware of it. Numerous drills all the time. You had to put these in the middle of the night. They get us out, put these sort of rubber suits on, and cursing and swearing. They weren't easy things to manage, especially if you. I was 54 at the time. But I suppose the important thing was that we shouldn't be seen to be a burden. We should not be a burden on the troops on whom we were reporting. That is, we were in every sense under military discipline. I mean, we could have, if you wanted to go home, you'd be allowed to go home, but no, I don't think you'd even be allowed to do that, because we knew the plan by then. So we were soldiers without the means of shooting, except film. But we took battlefield first aid courses. We took courses in protecting ourselves in the case of a nuclear or biological warfare attack. And we did the same as all the other soldiers in that respect. We shared their hardships, we shared their lives. We got really close to them, and because I had an exceptionally gifted cameraman who had himself been a soldier with the South African Army, and he understood soldiers. That was an enormous help. They all loved it.
So you were really sharing a soldier's life?
Oh yeah, we were.
All these stages.
No, we were living a soldier's life. Completely. We were living in a tent. Okay, we were going out and I talked to the Irish Hussars about media press relations and things, and I got to know and like them a lot. You know, we still celebrate our amazing victory every year on the 26th of 28th of February, I think.
Yes, you were saying earlier, I think, you know, in our last interview, how you bonded with soldiers.
Well, that's one of the things they want you to do. I see no harm in understanding the military mentality and to living a life as the soldiers live it, rather than camped in a hotel and come out and peer about for a few hours and go home. And I had the great advantage of having been a soldier. There was nobody still in the army from that time, nobody at all. But I had been a soldier before they were, and they understood and respected that. And also the fact that one had been in all these sort of shitholes and up the sharp end. I mean, I'd actually seen more wars than they had, and that sort of, you know, they... What soldiers don't like is if there are special privileges for the press, and there weren't. We lived just as they did.
Did you wear what they did?
Yes, it was part of that was a slightly vexed issue, but it, one of the rules was that we wore combat fatigues, just as they did, with a little thing on your shoulders which said war correspondent and a card which said in the event of capture that you were travelling with the army but not of it, as if that would stop you being shot. We looked entirely like soldiers, and even if we had wished to wear more casual or civilian clothes, we would not have been allowed to by our minders. It wasn't worth making an issue of it because they were absolutely adamant about it.
Were you the only BBC man in the desert?
No, I had Nigel Bateson with me, and also a sound man who injured himself early on, injured his back, and was thereafter used mainly as a spare driver. There was a radio correspondent, Joe Paley, and further back at divisional headquarters there was Kate Adie. She wasn't up the front with us, but she was roughly where the divisional general was, and she would sort of contribute. I don't know what she was doing because I wasn't there, but she was very helpful to me when I came crashing back 4 days later with my videotape. Very helpful. It is not universal for journalists to help each other, you should know.
Not even when you're in the same team, BBC?
Not at all. Well, I mean, I've always got on well with Kate, and that was terrific. But the great, it's a bit like party politics. The great rows are not between parties, but within them, the great enmities and rivalries. And so it is with journalists. I mean, I was out of it by then, but at the time of the NATO incursion into Kosovo, there were 19 BBC reporters on the ground. 19. Absolute mad. Of course, they end up competing with each other. I mean, as I speak, troops are going into Macedonia. There was an advance party of 400. There are 25 BBC people even then. I mean, it's got completely out of hand.
You mentioned the Basra Road. Did you actually see what had happened there?
I did, but later we cut it further north. What you're talking about is the pass just north of Kuwait City. I very much regret that I was not the first journalist there, because I would love to have described that scene. Very complex, actually. A mix of a dreadful carnage. It really was a pass, and the strike aircraft cut it off, and the tanks were fleeing, and of course all the cars with their loot were fleeing. So it was both a military and a civilian convoy. I know that Charles Wheeler described it as bombing a parking lot. I think that's unfair. This was a force that had invaded Kuwait, had seized it, and was fleeing in retreat, and they were hit. And to be sorry for them, you can be sorry for any soldier in any war, wounded, killed, whatever. But this war was started by these people, and if it had fallen to me to make that report, I would have done it in very measured terms. But he didn't, because I arrived a day after everybody else. I was doing something else.
Yes. What was the situation then when you arrived?
There were bodies still lying around. Just an awful lot of carnage, damage. It needed a lot of explaining, I felt. That it was sort of written up afterwards as a war crime. I don't buy into that. These were the people who had invaded Kuwait, fleeing from Kuwait.
And that was the Mitla Pass, was it? The part you
yes,
saw?
Yes, yes, yeah.
So how long did you sort of stay in that area?
I think we stayed there about 3 or 4 days afterwards, just camped across the road and sort of poking around a bit. Arthur Denaro, being a horseman, found the stables where the Kuwaiti army used to keep its polo ponies, of course. But it was quite clear to us that by then the job was over. Tom King, who was then Defence Secretary, came to visit all the troops in the desert. And I took by that time, the BBC had a satellite dish in Kuwait City and a new, fresh group of people come in. So I took the opportunity of hitching a lift on Tom King's helicopter. He
He was travelling with some other grand Fleet Street editors back to Riyadh, and then I hopped a taxi to Tehran, and my war was over.
Did you go into Kuwait City?
Yes, I did. Simply to hitch a ride on an aircraft.
What was your impression of it?
It had obviously been looted. It did not give the impression of a city that had been completely fought through. It was damaged in places. I mean, the serious damage actually was outside in the oil fields, and there was some quite heavy damage in the airport as well. But it wasn't as if there had been much in the way of street by street fighting. The Iraqi simply got up and fled.
Did you pick up the impression of the troops when the war ended? You know how they felt about that.
I think yes, I did. They were relieved. I mean, we had not imagined that tank regiments have fewer people than infantry regiments for obvious reasons. You only get four in a tank, and you'll get eight or so in an armoured personnel carrier. So they had about 250 men in the Queen's Royal Irish Hussars. What they hadn't imagined was that they'd all come out alive. There were two, I think, who'd been wounded, not as it happens by the Iraqis, but by American fire. And of course, the great tragedy was in the other brigade, the 4th Armoured Brigade, where men of the Royal Regiment of Fusiliers a whole armoured personnel carrier was shot up and they were killed. And there's never been a proper accounting of that, because all these vehicles were very clearly marked. And I think it was an A-10 tank buster. They fly very low. They must have been able to see it was not an Iraqi vehicle. But the whole, I suppose, the British had something like 34,000 troops in the area at that time, and the total casualties, including accidents, you know, being run over by a tracked artillery piece, and so on, was about 19, I think. Well, if you commit that many to a live firing exercise or an exercise anywhere, you're actually going to get people killed. It was statistically negligible, although of course these were 19 tragedies for 19 families. I think it gave us the idea that we could go to war in a fairly cost-free way, which, as I've written on a number of occasions, I find extremely dangerous.
And of course, there have been repercussions from that war, haven't there? You know, the Gulf War syndrome that many people feel.
Yes, I find that extremely mysterious. When I became an MP, I had a former Royal Army Medical Corps major, was one of my constituents, who died quite recently of this very mysterious illness. It could be a lot of things. It could be linked to the pesticides they were using in the deserts to control the insects. I think it's more likely to be linked to the injections given against anthrax and other presumed biological weapons the Iraqis might use. I don't think these were properly tested. I will admit I took advantage of my civilian status and declined to have those particular jabs. Well, because I didn't like being punctured anyway. I prefer to take my risks. That could be a cause of it, yeah. And of course, but you know, I don't think there can have been, apart from the few who were shot, may have been close to being hit by American warplanes, there should not have been too much in the way of shell shock, because there wasn't too much in the way of shells. I mean, I came through totally unscathed, and so did nearly everybody else.
Did you see any signs of blue on blue?
Well, I think it was two men in the recce platoon, which obviously goes out in front, got shot up, and they were wounded but not seriously. But the serious blue on blue casualties happened in the 4th Armoured Brigade, to which other journalists were attached.
The Iraqi soldiers that you saw, you know, that you described so well as you were going forward, what was your impression of their state?
They were the ones that had been survived the artillery bombardment, which was multiple rocket launchers. It's very nasty stuff to be under. They were dazed and shell-shocked. They were in a terrible state. And I think the medics were very busy patching them up, because one of the rules is that as soon as you're wounded, you're not treated as a combatant anymore. But we just rolled past them, as a matter of fact, rounded them up, left them inside barbed wire under a guard, and there were other battalions came up whose job was dealing with prisoners, but we hadn't expected to take them on such an enormous scale. So we found them, rounded them up, left them to other people. In fact, they were wanting to be taken prisoner. We'd go past them and they'd sort of wave at us, you know, because they knew they'd been abandoned. But there was no attempt at resistance at all.
And no sighting of the Republican Guard?
No, the Republican Guard had disappeared off. Yeah.
Did you get a feeling from the men you were with how they regarded Saddam's forces?
Well, they regarded them as much more formidable than they turned out to be. We had a lot of lectures about his order of battle, his strategy, his Soviet doctrine, his minefields. After all, this is a country that had waged a tough war against Iran for years. What surprised us was, in the end, how little will to fight there was. And I think, I mean, looking back on it, the whole operation could have been mounted a great deal earlier. But it was led by generals like Schwarzkopf, who had been colonels in Vietnam and had suffered there from the doctrine of incremental force. That is, you build up and you build up and you build up, and you get sucked in. Here they replaced that with a doctrine of overwhelming force. And I think a successful conclusion could actually have been achieved at least 2 months earlier, but they weren't going to take that chance.
It's interesting because this war was really the test of the New World Order, wasn't it? That great coalition of forces.
It was. With the strength of it, in that it was put together, and it did recuperate Kuwait, but also the weakness of it, that it was extremely fragile. It was put together solely for the purpose of winning back Kuwait, and as soon as that was achieved, there was no prospect really at all of continuing into Basra or Baghdad, because the coalition would have fallen apart. I think both the Egyptians and certainly the Syrians would have defected, and it was easier to call it a victory and leave the field of play, leaving Saddam Hussein in power, where at the time of speaking he still is. That doesn't bother me too much, but I think it might bother a lot of the Iraqi people.
Were there any moments within the period, you know, once the air war had started, where you thought, you know, there was danger to the coalition? I was thinking of the sort of Scud attacks on
We had one missile attack on a concentration of troops about 10 kilometers from us, but they're really in, I mean, we were in the desert for 40 days before the actual ground assault began. That was the only sign of resistance that we saw. The border with Saudi and Kuwait, where we were, was in fact marked with a berm, which is a great wall of sand, really. And that was breached by the combat engineers and the mine clearings, and they just rolled through. No resistance at all. No attempt at resistance.
The Scud attacks on Israel, did that cause anxiety?
Well, I mean, we heard about them. We listened to the BBC World News every night. I think if the Israelis had got involved, there were obviously political anxieties, that, you know, the whole coalition might have fallen apart, but political anxieties were not where we were at. We were dealing with survival in the desert and things like that.
Because the Yugoslav conflict overlapped with the Gulf, I think, didn't it? 1990.
Not really. It was brewing. There were a lot of false starts to the Yugoslav conflict, flashpoints that didn't quite happen. Round about the time of the Gulf War, but it became critical only when Slovenia announced its intention to declare its independence at the end of June 1991. And the Croats were, at that point, really pressured into doing the same thing. So these two announcements, I think it was about the 26th of June, they just declared independence. And at that point, two wars started, a short one in Croatia and a longer one about a short one in Slovenia and a long one about 7 months in Croatia. The Slovenian war lasted about 8 days, if you can call it a war. I think probably about 30 people were killed, including quite a few journalists. So there were four died on Ljubljana Airport. It was a it was the Slovenes had it easy because there was no significant, there was no Serbian minority in Slovenia. What there was some substantial barracks with Yugoslav army presence, and the orders came to the Yugoslavs to withdraw. And of course, they got ambushed as they did so.